everyone. Welcome back to another episode of A Real Page Turner with Dani Granza and Mara Meros. And today we are taking a trip to Shakespeare to talk about the play Macbeth and the new movie, The Tragedy of Macbeth. And we have a special guest with us tonight, our friend Travis Schick, who is also a alumni of the Maslow Creative Writing Program at Wilkes University. So welcome, Travis.
Thank you very much. Great to see you guys and ecstatic to be here.
Yes, well, we are thrilled to have you. I don't think we've done a Shakespeare before, have we, Donnie?
No, we haven't touched on old Billy Bob Shakespeare.
No. So now we are here. So, you know, the play was obviously written by William Shakespeare many times ago, Macbeth. And the movie, though, has had some more recent success since it was just, I would say, redone or reimagined. Is that correct, Donnie? It was just because it was up for some awards, right?
Yes. It came out last year, debuted on Apple TV Plus. The film was written and directed by Joel Coen, is, you know, one half of the famous Coen brothers, I believe. Yeah, this was his first solo effort directing. So it's very interesting there. It stars some dude named Denzel Washington. Maybe you heard of him. In the role of Macbeth, and also Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth. Others. So yeah, it was a critical acclaim. It has like a 92% score on Rotten Tomatoes. It was earned three Oscar nominations for Denzel Washington's performance, for Best Actor, as well as for cinematography and production design.
So, Travis, this was kind of your choice when we asked if you wanted to join us. So why did you, you know, want to do Macbeth and the tragedy of Macbeth?
So I think we should call this response of mine the full disclosure part.
Okay.
Just so everybody knows, I am not some Zen high priest expert in Shakespeare. I have no, you know, background academia, you know, in that field. I think I can qualify myself as a super fan though. And just to make a long story short, you know, I had the same background everybody else had. You know, they have you watch the Romeo and Juliet, the Zeffirelli film in high school or junior high. I think I did Henry IV Part One in college. And I had seen the Denzel Washington, Kenneth Branagh, Much Ado About Nothing when it came out in the 90s. Really enjoyed that a lot. And yeah, but I had a couple Shakespeare on DVD. I had a Merchant of Venice. And but when I came back from my last deployment, I'm in the military, my commander had asked me to give, I was like the history guy. So he wanted me to give a history presentation on the Balkans because we were going to Kosovo for the peacekeeping mission still going on there. And so during the presentation, I used a clip from Ray Fiennes' directorial debut. He did Shakespeare's Coriolanus, but set it in the Balkans. And I used a clip for it to kind of illustrate to the soldiers some points I was making about the history and what it means to Europeans. So when I got back, my dad was up visiting and I was like, hey, you got to see this thing. I know you're not a Shakespeare guy, but trust me, this is really something different. And I don't know what happened. Something snapped in my head, some lightning struck. I don't know what it was. But for the next 2.5 months, if my television was on, it was some Shakespeare DVD that I had hunted down on eBay. And one thing led to another. And now to the embarrassment of my children and the eye rolling of my wife, the last count, I'm over 240 different productions on DVD. Everything from, I have a couple of the silent films up to, you know, the more modern stuff. And it's one of those things, I think, that once you really have an appreciation of what's going on, there's just so much depth. It's like finding a new sport, you know, like you're watching Formula One racing, or, you know, it's just guys running around, driving around a circle, right? Or, you know, football. Yeah. They're just throwing this big skin around, or golf. They're just chasing a little white ball. But once you get past a certain point and realize there's all these other things that are going on that you didn't see that first time that are really interesting, it sort of sucks you into that world. And next thing you know, you're taking out a second mortgage to go get Super Bowl tickets or something.
So your mini copies of your DVDs for our younger audience, those are actual CDs that you put into a player to watch.
Well, now I got to explain what CDs are too.
Yeah.
Right. Oh gosh. Okay. They're like a flat disc.
Yeah.
So are they iterations of the same in different stylings. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a few different iterations of Romeo and Juliet. And, you know, so are they, it's not hundreds of different stories, is it?
No. There's, depending, most recent scholarship puts the number of plays that Shakespeare wrote at about 39. Some debate on that. So of those 39 plays, some of them are hardly ever produced. For example, Two Noble Kingsmen. Some of them, the big four tragedies are usually the ones you see the most often. It's Hamlet, King Lear, Macbeth, and Romeo and Juliet. And so, but every one of them, especially, and this is what I love about y'all's program, that it's not just the words on the page, it's also the production and the film as well, and where one ends and the other begins and how they kind of work with each other. Every production is a little different. And every interpretation is a little different. There are certain questions that Shakespeare doesn't answer that a production company has to come to a conclusion on before they go on stage or they go in front of the camera. And it's just this, you know, it, as with any type of film or play, there's just a million questions that have to be answered. And seeing how Anthony Hopkins answers it versus Ian McKellen versus Hopkins or Kenneth Branagh, they all have a little different take on it. It really, really is just a never.
Now, my sister told me today when I was telling her this is what we were doing on our episode that she told me it's on Amazon this month, A Midsummer's Night Dream from like the 20s or the 30s. Mm-hmm. She said it's 40 minutes long and she said it's like a total fever dream. She said it's mm-hmm. wild.
Yeah.
She was she's like, you know, it's 40 minutes. She's like, it's really good to watch. And that's what she had just said this to me like an hour ago.
Yeah. And if it's the one I'm thinking of, that's the one that Mickey Rooney plays. Mickey Rooney's like 9 or something. I mean, he's ridiculously young, but he plays Puck. And James Cagney plays Bottom the Weaver. And I think a lot of people kind of, I guess it's a love it or hate it performance, but I think it's one of the better Bottom performances. Cagney does a great job with it and really shows off his versatility.
She just said that to me and I thought that was really funny. The tragedy of Macbeth, I'm going to tell you, I struggled. Full disclosure.
right.
I tried. So I have a book of Shakespeare's plays because I really loved some of them. And I was reading it along watching the movie because I tried to read it alone. And it was just like, I can't, because it was written in the play format. And when you don't have different voices doing it, it's really hard, I think, to read. And I had to read along and I was like, oh my gosh. And then, I mean, they do cut things out. Like, you know, and what I found interesting is that they kind of moved it around too. Just said, you know, when I was trying to read along, I was like, oh wait. And then I jumped to like the next page. Yeah. It was like, they kind of just moved them around to make it cohesive on the screen. Mm-hmm. I think it almost like give you some backstory, but I struggled a little bit. Like and my full disclosure is I had to go to SparkNotes.
Understandable. It's tough.
I need like someone to tell me what's happening because I was getting lost in some of the characters, like, you know, like who was who at one point, and I was getting a little lost in it.
And I'm going to try my best to channel Joseph Fiennes on this one. When he, you know, it's almost kind of drives me a little crazy when I hear, you know, I'm not a teacher. I know that's a ridiculously difficult job and the challenges there, but for, you know, if you're going to introduce kids to Shakespeare, don't have them read it. I mean, the poetry is amazing. I got it. But you got it. I mean, it is written, it is designed, it is intended for a high quality troupe of actors to perform. And that's, if it wasn't for the performers, you know, my kids, believe it or not, I have dragged them to a number of Shakespeare performances trying to get that fear of what this is out of them to help, you know, I kind of figured it might make things a little easier for them when they're, you know, in English class, if they're not intimidated by Shakespeare. And really all I have to do is, I've learned, is just give them a basic idea of the plot and they're good. You know, if you've got a quality troupe of actors and actresses, they'll do the rest. And I mean, there's some plays that even I have a hard time reading through, but I'll watch the play over and over because I get it when the emotion's there, when the different characters are moving around the stage, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. And go ahead, Johnny. Sorry.
No, it's definitely interesting because actually, you know, I agree fully, like, you know, some things like need to be performed and, you know, something like, I don't want to call myself like a screenwriter because I've yet to have anything produced yet. fingers crossed. But, you know, I kind of think you take, like, write something, you take a different approach with it. And, like, you, like, have to, like, imagine things and, like, how this could be performed. So definitely, like, it's with Shakespeare, like with any play or film, you know, you have to see it, and it's hard to just read. So, like, it was a challenge, and, you know, so like the kind of like the old English style of writing,
right.
It can be a challenge, but definitely an interesting endeavor we took on.
Yeah,
Scotty, when you talked about them doing they were nominated for cinematography, and Travis, maybe you felt like this too, but I felt like the cinematography was very much so treating the actors like they were at a stage. Like the camera angle, it seemed like there was only. It was almost like they were approaching the stage and they would like enter in and then they'd be there and then they'd fade away. Like I felt like, I don't know if it was one single camera, how they were doing it, but you didn't, you know, it wasn't that quick movement camera that happens in other movies. Like I felt like it was very like almost they were filming like a stage because there was, you know, it's like they entered the stage, they said what they said, like there wasn't a ton of like over the top action, for lack of a better word. Like I don't know, I kind of like that's kind of impression, yeah. I got from the movie, which, you know, I think was effective for that in that instance. But yeah, I thought that was interesting because yeah. I kind of felt like, oh, this seems like they're just holding the camera still and people are entering in and then they're leaving and, you know, moving on to the next scene.
Right. And that's another one of those challenges or questions that have to be answered if you're putting Shakespeare on film. Is it going to be a filmed stage production? Is it going to be a straight up film, or is it going to be some mix in between? And because there are pluses and minuses, no matter which choice you make, you know, obviously film, you can get the intimacy. You can put that camera right up the actor's face in a way that a person in a stage production will never get to see that. But on stage, you can have multiple things going on without focus changing, you know, and which allows, it's kind of like going to a baseball game. Everybody can see everything on the field. It's not like somebody sitting in their living room just watching the batter and the pitcher duel. And yeah. And a great example of how that can work both ways, the RSC did a Julius Caesar with Joseph Patterson, but that is one of my favorite Julius Caesars. Absolutely wonderful production. And they actually did all three. They've got some things that are filmed like a regular movie. They've got some things that are filmed on a soundstage. And they've got some scenes that are filmed on an actual stage in front of a live audience. And it just blends seamlessly right through it. It makes total sense why it looks this way here and this way there. And they really magnified the pluses of each of those different techniques.
No, yeah. And now I thought Frances McDormand was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, I was surprised. Was she nominated, Donnie?
No, she did not.
Gosh, and I thought she was probably one of the strongest.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I really liked her. Like, I thought she was wonderful. And my other favorite was I loved the witches. I did. Yes. And I loved the way in the one scene, there was one witch. And though, you know, when reading it, it's supposed to be three witches,
mm-hmm.
but they kind of made her speak for all three. And then the visual, when she turned around, it was like three bodies, like without the reflection in the, like in the water. And I just thought that was really cool. Like, I think for me, the witches were like my favorite part because they were so weird.
Yeah. Like, and Fran McDermott.
They were really strange and dark. And I liked them.
Fran McDermott. I mean, watching her, she has said that, I mean, this was like, her whole acting career, people have been telling, oh, you would be a perfect Lady Macbeth. And you can see it on stage. I mean, this is that's a performance of a lifetime, I think, for her and what she was preparing to do, from what I understand. And I mean, you can just see it. She's putting her whole heart in that, and all of her professional expertise is coming to the fore, especially the sleepwalking scene towards the end and going up the stairs, yeah. and looking at the servant and the doctor. I'm like, oh, chills. Oh, it's great stuff. But I totally agree with you. Catherine Hunter is the actress who plays the witches.
Oh, and okay.
I don't know if you realize, am I allowed to do a spoiler here? I think.
Oh, yes. We tell spoiler alerts. Yes. Okay. Yes.
I don't know if you noticed the old man who is, you just see him a couple times to include the very end.
Oh, yeah. He's like hunched over.
Right. That is also Catherine Hunter.
Huh.
Yeah.
She really? Played both.
Yeah. And, you know, when you've got over 200 productions, I rarely ever say this is a definitive role or this is the definitive performance of that role, because, you know, Hamlet can be played in so many different ways. How can you say one is definitive? I actually, I come hell or high water, I was going to make sure I saw this at the theater because it did have a very limited theater release before it went to Apple. And seeing it in the theater when that opened up, I'm like, this could very well be the definitive Witches, for at least for me. I mean, my wife saw it and she's like, this has to be CGI. That can't really be her. I'm like, no, that's her.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
I really liked that.
Different voices. There's another play that is rarely ever produced called Timon of Athens. And I think RSC, she played Timon, the lead role, did a fantastic job in that too. But I think this one, to have such a small role and, you know, run the risk of possibly upstaging the two heavyweight leads, I think she nailed a home run there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leads who have a combined 5 Oscars between them.
Yes. Yes.
And 15 to 20 nominations. So, you know, pretty.
And I thought the crows were visually very, like, a good ad, because you can't see that in the play. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't see that when you read it. And that's something I think would be very hard to transition on a stage. But cinematically, those crows were pretty cool. And I said to Donnie, I said, it's giving me Schitt's Creek vibes. I don't know if you, do you watch Schitt's Creek, Travis?
No.
Oh, the lead Moira Rose is in a movie called the what is it called, Donnie?
The Crows Have Eyes.
The Crows Have Eyes.
Yes.
She has a scene where it's black and white and these crows. And I was like, oh my God, I'm getting Moira Rose vibes from these crows.
Yeah.
And it was really funny, but I struggled. I like talking about it. And I think it was good in retrospect, but while I was watching it, I was like, oh boy. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
I did like, you know, it's a very ominous, you know, work, but, you know, and the movie sort of had like this real ominous tone, I think. Travis, I want to get, what was your opinion on having it in black and white? Do you think that was an effective choice?
I think it was very effective, especially for the way they were filming it. Because that was almost,
yeah.
What I understand, it was almost all done on soundstage. And, I think that and the cinematography, what really impressed me was its complexity. It's not just black and white, but the use of shadows. I mean, there's a lot of shots in there that are like, wow, how do you even do that? You know, how do you make the dagger shine like that and not light up the rest of the door? And the one that I immediately wanted to compare it to was the Orson Welles' it's a 1948, I think, version of Macbeth, which obviously black and white as well. But it, you know, it's Welles, right? So a lot of shadows, a lot of, you know, high intensity cinematography. But that's a much, like, it's almost like a much more crude version. And you saw that in the set design as well. The Wells version, the castle is, it's almost melting underneath the actor's feet. It's just this decaying, sloppy, I mean, it looks like mud. But then you go to this version and it's black and white, heavy shadows, but all the lines are clean. It's all this like postmodern, you know, almost brutalism, straight lines, straight shadows, everything, no dirt, no mud, which is a big contrast, I think, to most modern Macbeths. They're very dirty. The Fassbender Macbeth, it's a wash in mud and grime and all that kind of thing, trying to get that medieval feel to it. But I really think they did a great job with that, with not only the black and white choice, but that playing with the shadows, so to speak. And as Macbeth starts to go downhill, he disappears in the shadows more and more when he's talking to murder.
I thought Denzel Wash did a really good job of, like, you know, when you first see him, he's very confident and he's, you know, and then the end, you kind of see him like devolve into that madness where he's losing his mind and hearing voices and he's very paranoid. And, you know, like, I thought he did I think he was really very good in it in showing that kind of progression of kind of madness.
Yeah. Just earth-shattering performance, I think, from him. And he does such a great job with his conversational tone. I mean, you don't feel that he's an actor on a stage reciting the great lines of Shakespeare. No, he's talking to you. He's talking to the person next to him. And he just does a great job with that. And the other thing that it was right from the very beginning. I'm like, oh, that is brilliant right there. Like I said, like the Fassbender, again, Macbeth, you know, dark, gritty. You know, it's a very bleak landscape, even in the words. But it's Denzel Washington. Everybody loves Denzel Washington. Even when he's in a movie where he's a bad guy, you still want to hang out with him because Denzel Washington's a cool guy, right? So I think they played that to their advantage, because the first time you see him on the screen, it's not you know, the howling wind or the downcast face. It's what's he do? He's laughing. The first thing, your first experience with Denzel on screen is laughter. And you're like, wait a minute, this is Macbeth I'm watching, right? Macbeth doesn't laugh. He's gloomy. He's nihilistic. He doesn't laugh. But, oh, it's the Denzel Washington we all know and love. I want to hang out with this guy again. But then you watch, and that's what makes that fall even more sublime, because you started off with that person you already know and you want to joke around with, and you're watching him through his failed plotting and bad decisions and all this just going deeper and deeper and deeper into the hole.
Yeah,
that is. That reminds me of something. I was like, I have to talk about like a different movie, but as little it was kind of like, it reminds me a little of like Jack Nicholson and The Shining. And it was funny, like one story I heard about that movie is that like Stephen King like hated that version of The Shining, and one thing that they didn't like was that like it was Jack Nicholson, and he was known for playing like off kilter characters, so his slow descent into madness wasn't that surprising at that. But it's an excellent point. Like it was like with Denzel Washington, you know, starting up, you know, a very genial guy, not, you know, doesn't play too many off kilter characters like that. So to see him slowly descend into madness is very interesting there. So
yeah. And I think it hits a little deeper, you know, you feel a little bit more, because like, oh, not him, you know. And I can't remember who said it, but some commentator I read some time ago was saying that, you know, Othello and Macbeth are the two Shakespearean plays that no matter how many times you see it, you want to jump up on stage at a certain point and say, no, don't do it. Don't do it. You know, but they do it anyway. You know?
Yeah. And I didn't actually really know much of this story. You know, you hear about it and you hear some of the famous lines like, out damn spot, right? I didn't really realize that Lady Macbeth was truly like the protagonist behind Macbeth wanting to come to power earlier. You know, Macbeth was kind of happy to let it play out and get what he was being awarded, and knowing that the long term where he'd be, but she wanted it sooner. And kind of pushed him to that, which I don't think I really realized that. Like, I don't really remember that much reading this, and I'm sure I did read it in high school or somewhere, but I just don't remember that. So I thought that was interesting when I started listening to it and like watching it and reading it again. I'm like, oh, she's kind of the troublemaker here, you know, impatient and power hungry.
Yeah, it's really actually from what I've read, in the 1800s, it was much more common to see her taking a much more domineering role in the Victorian era. There's one actress, her name escapes me right now, but she was fairly tall and would actually be cast with male actors playing Macbeth who were shorter. So her physical presence alone was, you know, visually, you know, telling him what to do. This is what you need to do. And, you know, stick your courage to the sticking place. Da, 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 da. But
that's interesting.
Yeah. But it's both of them want it. And I think it's the fact that their willingness to go down this bad path kind of waxes and wanes. And the other one is always there to shore them up in their bad decision. And that's one of the ironic twists. And you'll hear it about everywhere, that the Macbeths are really Shakespeare's happy couple, because normally in Shakespearean plays, there's a lot of people falling in love, but you don't see a lot of marriages that people have been together for a long time and are still supportive of each other. You don't see that very often. And here, yes, they're going down a bad path, but they are still totally supportive of the other one, or the goal that they think is best for the other person. And another interesting twist that they've made on this version that you usually don't see, you know, were you surprised when you saw Denzel for the first time and saw the gray in his beard? You know, they purposely played it and dressed them up makeup wise and such to put them in their 60s. Where normally a Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are usually in their early 30s. They're on the rise to power. They're the young power couple. Here, by them being in their 60s, now you see it more as this is their last chance. This is their last opportunity to do something, especially when you consider they don't have children. And that gets mentioned numerous times, or a couple times in the play, sort of the power of that. The historical Lady Macbeth, this was actually her second marriage. So the implication that the child that he refers to was from a previous marriage did not survive.
Ah, okay. I was kind of wondering, like, why, like, you know, I just thought, you know, it was to the plot line that they didn't have children.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Yeah. And there's, that's another one of the many facets that the two leads, you know, how much they want to lean on that little bit of information or not when they're rendering the scene. Anthony Scheer, the late great Anthony Scheer, just passed away last year. I read recently that I think it may have been Harold Bloom or no. Somebody else. Something. Anyway, the three great Macbeth productions of the 20th century were Ian McKellen and Judi Dench, Laurence Olivier and Vivien Leigh, and Anthony Scheer and Harry Walter. And she leans much more heavily on that theme of barren couple. And it's a great effect. Great effect.
That's interesting the way each, you know, actor or an actress brings that to the table and what they want to bring out in the story. Donnie, anything else?
No, I think this is, you know, very deep, you know, powerful episode.
Travis, you are a wealth of Shakespearean knowledge. Yes. And plays and, you know, books and DVDs, as the new word. Yes. This is our new word we've introduced to some people today, DVD. But that's a paper in itself, Travis, you know, the comparing and contrast of Shakespearean.
Oh, no doubt.
Plays and movies.
Yeah. But my motto is a day without trivia is a day without sunshine. So I brought my.
I'm like a daily Jeopardy watcher. So I'm with you. Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of your insights. Yes.
If there were just two other points, I just want real quick, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right along those lines of things that you may not, I didn't realize at least one when I saw it the first time. So, every production, they're going to modify the play, the words of the play in some way, shape, or form. That you mentioned the, you know, some of the conversations seem to be moved around, or another one that they makes this version very different is the role of the Thane of Ross, who is the snake-like guy. The form-fitting cowl.
Oh, yeah, yeah, drunk. Yeah.
Okay, I mean, yes. Right? Yeah. So yeah. The Thane of Ross, to me, that was always like it's like background noise. It was just an extra character. It really wasn't a big deal. But they took that role and they injected it in different places that normally you would not see him. And they gave some lines that other people normally gave and gave it to Ross. They had him standing on the balcony overlooking Macbeth when he says that the king has been murdered. And really shockingly, when Lady Macbeth goes up the steps and does the shush thing, that's normally her last scene. You never see her again.
Oh.
This production, they had her show up when the army is coming to hit the castle and everybody's running around freaking out.
Yes.
You see her at the top of the steps and Ross walks by and sees her like, oh, and he goes up the steps and then she's dead. And they never tell you what happened there. You know, why?
Right. Because yes. So when I was watching that, I initially thought that he killed her.
Right.
And then when I go back and read like the spark notes and read, you know, my cliff notes for it, they say she killed herself.
Yeah. And that's why.
They really did a sleight of hand there in the movie because you're not really sure what's become of her.
And I think they've really made the Ross character played by Alex Hassel, who does a phenomenal job. He's another RSC, Royal Shakespeare Company actor, who's been in a number of their productions. But they are basically, it's almost like they're casting him as a fourth witch because he's a manipulator. He's out there making things happen for some unknown dark reason. And the two great examples are, number one, when Banquo is murdered, if you read the play, when the two murderers are waiting for Banquo and his son to arrive, a third murderer shows up and they're like, what are you doing here? Well, Macbeth told me to be here. Okay, well, hop on over. Let's take care of this. He only has a couple of lines, but Shakespeare never explains who the third murderer is. He never comes back, which has led to some really interesting theories on how that could be played. It could even be theoretically played as Macbeth in disguise to commit the murder himself. But in this case, they made it Ross because he's the manipulator, right? So Ross is now the one that shows up. And the lines support this because it implies that he has some familiarity with the family. But what is different, instead of having Florence, the boy, run off and disappear, in this version, Ross captures him. And at the
very you also end, think he's dead till the end.
Right. And at the very end, Ross shows up, takes the boy on the horse, and he rides off. And here's your crows again. He doesn't ride off into the sunset. He rides where? He rides into the earth, literally. I mean, he's going down a hill and you're expecting him to come up the road in front of the camera, but he doesn't. He goes into the darkness and all these crows come up. And you're like, oh my gosh, what is this? You know, and it, I haven't heard a definitive what we're trying to say by that scene, but it really is powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Now that you say that, and it took me some time to realize I didn't know what the word Thane was when they were calling him like the Thane of Cordor, like the Thane of Cordor and the Thane of this. I didn't know what the word Thane meant until I like looked it up. It was like, what are they, like a small king of somewhere, like kings of certain lands?
It's the same thing as an earl.
Okay.
And and what makes that interesting is there's a lot of speculation of the political motives of this play, because when this play was written, Elizabeth is no longer on the throne. It's James the First. James is from the Stuart, the Scottish line. And so he's going to be, you know, hey, we're having a Scottish play. Check this out. And so Duncan's son, who is gets the throne at the end of the Malcolm at the end of the play, his line will eventually fall in revolution as well. But he's the one who introduces, who basically tells all the Thanes, okay, you're now earls.
Okay.
So this is all history that probably would have been known to a lot of people in the audience at the time. And another key piece is that James the First, way into witchcraft, totally believed it, wrote a book about it, and told everybody who would listen that he was almost killed on this sea voyage by these incantations that he believed were made by these witches. And isn't it ironic that the three witches keep the thumb of a pilot, you know, a sailor.
Yeah.
You know, things like they keep referring, and it's like, you start to see these things connecting now, right?
That was weird. Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah. But, and the other thing I wanted to mention real quick, if I may, and just to kind of highlight again, like I said, I just love seeing the differences of interpretation and the variety and the way of looking at things. It's the dagger speech, because that was the other part of this film that I'm like, oh, brilliant. I don't think I've seen that one before, you know, for a play that's 400 years old, and to come up with something new that isn't gimmicky, but it's just a really cool interpretation. Normally, the dagger, you're either going to hang a fake dagger from a string or something, or have him pull a dagger out, is probably most common on stage, or it's just metaphorical. Like the Roman Polanski version in the 70s apparently got a lot of grief by some critics saying, you know, because he actually sees the ghostly image of a dagger in the air in front of him. They're like, no, it's metaphorical. What's wrong with you? Why are you even bothering with that kind of thing? But you see it a lot more often now. And the Folger Library did a really cool version in partnership. They did Macbeth in partnership with Penn and Teller, the magician.
Yeah.
So in that one, Macbeth is sitting in front of a mirror doing that dagger soliloquy. And you see his reflection in this large mirror. But you also see the reflection of a dagger suspended in the air that does not exist in real life in front of the mirror.
Hmm.
And that was one of the Penn and Teller tricks in there, right? And so, you know, seeing something new that really makes sense and really works so well as Denzel Washington, you know, you feel him starting to, he's getting this courage. He's going to do it. Up tonight, I'm going to kill this king. And as he's having this debate with himself, he's storming down this hallway, and he sees the dagger down at the end. It's shiny. There's a dagger before me. But it's not until he gets in the hallway that you realize, oh no, it's just the doorknob, you know? So the dagger's really there, but it's also metaphorical. I'm like, oh, that's right. Cool. It really worked. Yeah.
Yeah. So much nuance, right? It's so
crazy. Yeah. And like I said, the more it's one of those things. I mean, there's a reason that this guy's name is still a household word 400 years after his death. You know, it's because there's just so much there that, you know, you can spend lifetimes. You know.
That's
good old great. Billy.
You love to do that. You love to call him that.
Oh yeah, of course.
Oh my gosh. Well, Travis, thank you so much. You've given us so much to think about and so much insight. Like, it makes me want to go back and like now maybe watch it again.
And we didn't even talk about the curse.
I know there's so much to unpack.
Yeah.
But thank you for sharing your knowledge with us and our listeners. And I hope that they are excited about Shakespeare now and to go back and, you know, look at all the different iterations of, you know, just one play and all the different ways that it can be interpreted on the stage and on the screen.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you guys so much for the invitation.
Yeah. Donnie, any wrapping up words from you?
No, just thank you so much for joining us, Travis. It's been an absolute pleasure. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So, listener, keep reading
and keep watching.